Countless Hollywood films have been set in it. Also, best-selling novels, weddings, concerts, marathons, first kisses, and final words. Central Park is an iconic part of the American consciousness. Andrew Blauner collected a wide range of perspectives on it for his latest anthology called Central Park, which includes fiction and nonfiction from 19 writers and essays from two of the park's highest officials. It's published by Bloomsbury and brings editor Andrew Blauner to our show, along with writer Adam Gopnik and Doug Blonsky, president of the Central Park Conservancy. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Hey, Leonard.
When Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux won the design competition for the park in 1858, what did they conceptualize? Is it pretty much what we have today?
Yeah, I don't think there's that much of a difference. I think what they really wanted to do was create an escape for New Yorkers that couldn't afford to go up to the Adirondacks.
But it did involve forcing some people out of their homes, didn't it?
Yeah, there was a section of the park where, unfortunately, eminent domain was used for one of the first times, and that was up in the area around West 85th Street. Seneca Village is what it was called.
Now, Calvert and Vaux also did Prospect Park, which was pretty much a wild space to start with, but they had to fabricate a wild space in Central Park, didn't they?
Yeah, basically it was a denuded landscape. All the water bodies, everything you see in Central Park today was completely man-made. The only one part of the park, the Manhattan Schist rock outcrop, is really what they used as the frame of the park, and they built everything around that.
And you said that they wanted to make it as reach as many people as possible. So it touched a lot of different neighborhoods at the time.
Well, actually, what's interesting, most of New York City was below 23rd Street. So it was also used as an economic engine. New York City had to compete with the other cities of the world. And fresh drinking water and the park, I think, is one of the two most important reasons why everybody grew up around the park. And quickly, you saw this real estate expansion up north, and the park became a happening place to live as well.
Andrew, you wrote that Olmsted and Vaux designed a gate to accommodate every class. What are the names of some of the entrances?
Well, I think that's one for Adam to field, I think, actually.
I think I said Adam, didn't I?
No. Anyway, hey, I'm here. Yeah, it's one of the cool things about the park is that they gave the various entrances to the park these beautiful, fanciful names that suggest the incredible range and spectrum of people who could come in. There's the Miner's Gate. There's the Engineer's Gate. There's one that I love, the Stranger's Gate, which is over around 110th Street on the west side. And then there's the one that I actually wrote a book around, the Children's Gate at 75th and 5th Avenue. And in this lovely, poetic, whimsical way, they suggested that this was indeed a park for all the people and for all the kinds of people, from the very small to the very new, who might come in.
Well, do you think they achieved their goal? Aren't the streets it borders on among the most expensive real estate in the city?
Well, the borders around the park have changed a great deal over time. Of course, when my great-grandfather, as I suspect yours, remembers nights spent sleeping in the park when they would come in from the Upper West Side, when it was hardly in any sense an expensive part of the city. The north end of the park still, of course, borders on Harlem and has always had some of that of the character around Lasker Rink and so on. No, I think, Leonard, in plain English, it was an absolute, unqualified, and ongoing success as a democratic institution. You know, one of the things that's fascinating about Olmsted as a man is that before he designed a square inch of park anywhere in the world, he was one of the great American journalists. He was one of the great founders, really, intellectually, of the New York Times. And he went down south to what were still the slave states in the 1850s. And he looked and he said, what is it that separates the civilization of the North from the civilization of the South? And he said, it's exactly that the North is filled with what he called, beautiful phrase, commonplace civilization. All kinds of things from glee clubs to volunteer fire departments that enable people to come together from very different social classes and from very different backgrounds and for the purposes of 1 minute or two or 1 day or two, unite. And that's exactly what he wanted Central Park to be, a place that would bring people together from very different backgrounds. And it did that then, and I think in an unqualified way it does it to this day.
Of course, that was before the draft riots, but that's a whole other issue. Andrew, through the stories you collected in this anthology, does it seem the park has accomplished what Olmsted and Vaux had in mind?
It does. It's I think we talk a lot about the paradoxes of the park, that it divides east side from west side, but it also unites the two sides of the park. And that's the overriding effect that has transcended time, is that it is the great democratizer. It is a great unifier. People have so many different opinions. A lot of people have animus toward New York, but it seems like everybody – I liken it in some way to people – love or hate the Yankees, but everybody loves Yogi Berra, with whom I work. People have very mixed feelings about New York, but everybody loves the park. But within the park, everybody has something special that's their favorite part of the park.
And the park has meant different things to different people over the years. There was a time when, didn't Robert Moses want to have Joseph Papp charge for Shakespeare in the park? Because he wanted to some degree to keep the riffraff out. There were all these there were attempts to prevent demonstrations and free concerts in the park in the 60s as well. Now it seems to be a place where anybody can do anything.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of it. I mean, the park is completely open. I'm always, you know, one of the things that I'm amazed about, I think Olmsted, if he was here today, he would actually be shocked how wonderful the park is, because towards the end of his career, he was actually so concerned that nobody would understand the importance of the park and how to maintain it and management. So to come back home 160 years later, I think you'd be shocked to see that the park works, I think, far beyond what he would believe.
Although you're right that it was almost lost in the 1980s. What were the problems at the time?
Well, you know, I think during the 60s and 70s, there was really no leadership, and it really is about accountability and leadership. And several little friends groups started popping up in the park to take back projects, the Central Park Task Force, the Central Park Community Fund, the Friends of Central Park, and Gordon Davis, who was the Parks Commissioner at the time, brought these groups together, and it was actually a merger of not-for-profits. And Central Park Conservancy was created out of that, with Betsy Barlow Rogers being the first president and administrator, and it really brought accountability back to the park, and that was what was important, leadership and accountability.
Andrew, how many of the pieces in this collection were published before?
Of the 19 pieces, I believe 13 are original and exclusive to the book.
So you commissioned them.
And yes, exactly.
And you've gathered stories about Central Park from many authors, but we don't hear much about your personal connection. Do you have a Central Park story?
I have a very deep personal connection, and my day job, as it were, is a literary agent representing other people's books. But it was actually about 3 years ago I finished the last collection called Brothers, in which you were actually featured. And I was looking for the next project, and I was also harboring very serious thoughts about moving out of New York for the first time.
Before listeners start thinking there's some kind of collusion here, I declined to participate, but my brother wrote a piece in which he talked about me. I had nothing to do with that.
Not at all. No, okay. No. I should say you were the object, not the subject. But in any case, I grew up...
Because there are suspicious people out there.
The subject rather than the instrument.
Well, I estimated this morning that between the age of 6 and 18, I was probably in Central Park 7 or 8,000 times.
Really?
And that was just before I went to college.
Were you growing up in the area?
I went to collegiate school on the Upper West Side, and I grew up on the Upper East Side, so I was back and forth. And it was our home field for collegiate school, and it was the site of a lot of firsts. And it was also where I ended up on the afternoon of September 11th, and it's played, like for so many of your listeners and so many New Yorkers, so many different roles over the years.
In The Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield asks where all the park's ducks go in the winter, and Marie Wynne wrote a piece in which she answers his questions.
She does, but you don't expect me to give that away.
Adam, your piece was about returning to a New York that was different from the city you'd left. You'd gone to Paris?
Yeah, back in the 90s, you know, one of the things that's sort of amazing about the park is that you never step into the same park twice, that the park that our great-grandparents remember, where you slept in the summer before the era of air conditioning, is different from the first park that I knew in New York in the 70s, which was funky and terribly run down in some ways, but was beginning to fill up with boomboxes and roller skaters, beginning to have another kind of recreational life.
And only a really brave person would have slept in the park at that time.
In the 70s, would have been a brave person, but back in the 20s and 30s, it happened all the time. Mm-hmm. In that era, before air conditioning, people used the park that way regularly, and they're full of memories of it, just as they used to go in for those great symphony concerts, which were a regular feature, which, unfortunately, we no longer have to the same degree. By the time I got back, around 2000, New York was going through still one more transformation. It was becoming the latte and stroller city that, to some degree, it remains. And as you say, then went through 9/11, and that period, then the park became a terrifically important kind of green lung in the middle of the city in a time of enormous tension. That's what Olmsted wanted. That's very much what Olmsted wanted. He wanted a park for the people that would adapt itself to different circumstances. It's one of the reasons, you know, the architecture of the park, we don't think about this enough perhaps, has no grand LA. It has no European organizing unmistakable architecture. It's a centrifugal design spread out all over. Hard to find your way around in Central Park at sometimes, but the experience of the Ramble is very different from the experience of the Great Lawn, and the Great Lawn is very different from the zoo. It is a park of many things.
Did you think about Central Park when you were in some of the famous gardens of Paris, like
the
Luxembourg?
In fact, I wrote a long piece about Olmsted in the park while I was in Paris for exactly that reason. Because for all of their beauty and delicacy and charm and history, the parks of Paris, the Bois de Boulogne or the Luxembourg Gardens, are radically different, are very undemocratic spaces. They're spaces that are surveyed, that were designed for aristocratic pleasures, and still bear that imprint in the way that they're organized, and everything from the way that there's always a surveillant sitting at the center of the Luxembourg Gardens looking out in a supervisory way over the kids. Those are old-fashioned aristocratic spaces. Couldn't be more different from the democratic spirit of Central Park.
Yeah, you don't see kids running around in the parks of Paris the way you do in Central Park.
Not freely, not improvising games, not side-by-side with other kids with a boombox. You don't see that same kind of variety of experience.
Did you, when you came back, have any nostalgia for the what you'd left, what you describe as ugliness, the hookers, the beautiful despair?
You know, we all have nostalgia for everything we've experienced, and it's hard not to feel it for that. G.K. Chesterton once said that people who are sentimental about nothing end up being sentimental about everything. And I think that's a little bit true about New Yorkers. We remember everything kindly, even things that perhaps don't demand such kind reminiscence. But yes, of course, I remember and miss that funky city of the 70s, and I have my affection for it. I do think that the park now, at this moment, with the Conservancy working, is more like the park that Olmsted dreamed of than it has been at any time since it was built.
Andrew, were there other authors who wrote about significant transformations in the park?
Oh, yeah. Well, inadvertently, one of the themes in the book is, in addition to being a lot of very deeply personal, emotional family stories, but in part because of the age of some of the writers, perhaps, but there is this trajectory of people who grew up in the 70s, who experienced this sort of bad old days, as it were, and who saw it through, thanks, I won't say in large part, but maybe almost entirely to the Conservancy in 1980, has made the park what it is today.
We're talking about Central Park, which is the subject of a collection that has been edited by Andrew Blauner, published by Bloomsbury. Mr. Blauner is here, along with Adam Gopnik, the writer, who is one of the contributors, Doug Blonsky, who also contributed. He's the president of the Central Park Conservancy. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with a discussion of a new anthology called Central Park, published by Bloomsbury. The editor is Andrew Blauner, and the contributors include Paul Auster, Thomas Beller, Buzz Bissinger, Bill Buford, Susan Cheever, Jonathan Safran Foer, Mark Halperin, a lot of Francine Prose, pretty much everybody who's ever appeared on this radio show. Adam Gopnik,
hey.
The person who oversees the park, and I think that's really important because the park, if anything, one of the reasons we love the park is because of what it is today. Now I'm talking about Doug Blonsky, who is president of the Central Park Conservancy. Andrew Blauner put this together. You said you were searching around for a topic, and you decided Central Park?
I did. I'd felt such a connection to the park for so long, and I felt like the park was ready for its close-up. And we're sort of having the Central Park moment now, where there's a photography exhibit, there's a documentary. As I started to think seriously that I was going to move out of the city, it dawned on me how much you take the park for granted.
Do you think visitors to the city see the park differently than New Yorkers do? What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I think It's very interesting. When New Yorkers use the park, they clearly come in and it's their backyard. And there's a comfort with it. And when I look at tourists now, and I've watched the evolution of this over the years, tourists, when I started in 85, didn't come in the park. They would walk up to the front gate and they would ask you, can you go in, holding their wallets and putting their wallets in their front pockets. Mm-hmm. Now tourists come in the park and they revel in it. I think they are looking at it more like the masterpiece of landscape architecture that Olmsted and Vaux created. And, you know, they're overwhelmed with its beauty. And New Yorkers, I think, and Andrew and I were talking about this a little earlier, take it for granted. And I don't say that at all in a negative way because it is their backyard.
Well, people from other countries know that Olmsted and Vaux's design influenced parks all over the world. And to some degree, they're also coming to see a work of art, whereas we're just going to the park that's in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, as we've been talking about today, Central Park is a work of architecture. Exactly. It's a work of art. It is a made thing rather than an enclosed thing. And I think that as the problems of urbanism become more and more acute, the question of how you make a green space in the city, Central Park, instead of looking older, looks more radical than ever to European eyes.
A listener said there used to be an amusement park railroad that ran around the park. He's seen photos of it, but it's no longer there. Do you know anything about it, Doug?
Yeah, I believe it was up in the north end of the park along the north wall behind the Harlem Mirror.
Mm-hmm. Is that the sort of thing that just disappears because it's impossible to maintain?
You know, part of it was probably because of maintenance. Part of it maybe be because it wasn't just economically a viable business. So.
Well, the park is expensive to maintain, isn't it? The Conservancy has raised more than $600 million to restore and maintain the park. How does that number compare with some of the expenses on other public spaces around the city?
Well, I think with all the new public spaces coming online, you've got the Brooklyn Bridge Park, you've got the High Line, you've got the Battery. I think people are starting to understand the maintenance costs of parks. You know, it's interesting. Central Park went from 12 million visitors a year in the early 80s to 40 million now. And our annual budget's about $45 million a year to maintain and to restore the park. So there's the capital side of that in there as well. You know, you have that many visitors in a park, it's a tough challenge to keep it to the high standards that you need to do it.
Now, Adam, your piece is called Through the Children's Gate, a Home in New York. Jonathan Safran-Foer also contributed a story about children filling every inch of the park. What was your take on that?
Did you connect to it? Yes, of course. I mean, I think that's been one of the themes of the park in the last 10 years. But, of course, the park changes as you change with it. As I wrote in The New Yorker about a year ago, we were converted more or less at 10-year-old's gunpoint to become a dog family, and now we're acutely aware of the dog civilization within the park. Dogs are allowed off-leash until 9 a.m., and there's this amazing thing. It's like Edward Hicks' The Peaceable Kingdom. Every morning from 6 till 9, when dogs run free in the park, the park belongs to them, and they form packs and they form friendships. And, of course, the people who accompany them clump around and watch, and they form friendships too. It's that kind of social adaptability of the park that makes it so beautiful. You cease watching your children and you start watching your dog.
Should I be surprised that Jonathan Safran-Foer's piece is about Central Park? After all, he lives a block away from Prospect Park.
Right.
And Prospect Park is, despite the fact that it's by the same designers, is a totally different kind of park. Mm-hmm. Was that their intention?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of people will look at it, and you know, Central Park is my favorite park. But you think of Prospect Park.
I think they're both wonderful.
They're both wonderful. And Adrian Benepi, actually, our parks commissioner, summed it up really well. The Prospect Park is a smaller Central Park on steroids. and if you look at it, you know, Central Park has 7 water bodies. They realize, you know, maybe we should have a few less water bodies, but let's make them a little bigger. You know, Central Park has 7 meadows. You know, Prospect Park, let's have one great meadow and make it a little bigger and really make it stand out. So I think in some respects, design-wise, they accomplished something even greater in Prospect Park.
You know, talking about kids in Central Park, one of the great kind of ironies of contemporary New York life is that for the first time ever, the impulse, the magnetic impulse, runs from Manhattan back into Brooklyn. So my 17-year-old loves going to Prospect Park, even though he grew up near Central Park. It's a different kind of glamour that people like Jonathan Safran-Foer and Jonathan Lethem and Paul Auster have imbued Brooklyn with.
In Thomas Beller's piece, Negative Space, he writes about growing up and the changes he experienced in the fast-paced city. But the park remains a consistent, almost magnetic pull. But that's despite what we have discussed earlier. The park has changed over the years, hasn't it? I mean, there was a time when there was a sense that it was dangerous to go in the park. There was another time when a lot of the people, the city fathers, didn't want us to go into the park for anything other than to sit on the benches.
Well, I think originally when Olmsted and Vaux created it, there was a sense they were even nervous about the fact that they wanted to make sure that the citizens of the city, the everyday person, could get up there and use it. I mean, again, it was not that easy to get to Central Park in the very beginning, so there were some real concerns. But it did create transportation systems that helped the whole city grow. And then there was a period of time where I think people thought that you should just come in the park and sit. I mean, Olmsted had strict rules about coming in the park, how you should dress, how you should talk. Your dog should be on a leash no longer than 6 feet.
It encouraged the development of Upper Manhattan. The Dakota was called the Dakota because it was felt that it was as far away from the city as the Dakotas.
That's absolutely right. So it was a great economic generator back then, and also in the 80s when the Conservancy started. It helped bring the city out of the economic funk that it was in from the 70s.
Andrew, you say that when most people are asked what their favorite part of New York is, the majority say Central Park. But then when they're asked for their favorite part of the park, the answers are never quite the same.
Right. That's what I've found, and I think that comes through in the stories in the book as well. I mean, there are as many stories about Central Park as there are people who've been in the park. It's a very personal, very intimate relationship. The other two books that I put together were about people. They're, again, they're brothers and coaches, and this is about a place, but it's an even more personal, intimate collection of memoirs, really, is what they are.
So each person's idea of what the park means is different depending on their experience with it, their connection to it.
I was talking to Doug before. I ran the New York Roadrunners race a week ago Saturday, and I knew it would be a great experience, but I was completely unprepared for what an emotional experience it was. It was a Proustian experience. At every turn, here was the place where I used to play football with my father. There's Mount Sinai Hospital where I was born. Here's the place where my best friend, here's the place where first date almost ended. It means different things to different people, but over time it also plays different parts for different people in their lives.
There was a time when Hollywood loved to use Central Park as a place where romances began, or where people would meet when they were in the midst of a romance. We don't see that much anymore.
Do you remember in The Out of Town, there's that funny Jack Lemmon movie, the park becomes a kind of dystopia. It becomes the hell that the out-of-towners are caught in. It was very typical of the image of New York in the late 60s and early 70s, too.
So the park went from being the place that was just beautiful, especially in the snow or in a misty rain, to a place where you were scared out of your wits if you drifted too far away from the main streets.
Exactly. But, you know, again, that's always been true of Central Park, though Olmsted had certain ambitions and ideals for it. One of the astonishing things is how quickly the park was taken by people. I did a whole thing, a series of lectures on winter last year, and fascinating to see how ice skaters took over the park already in the 1860s. Some of the greatest New York imagery are the engravings that Winslow Homer made.
And Currier and Ives also did images of people skating in the park.
That's right. Now, skating in the park has become a much more limited thing because it doesn't have that element of sexual display that it did for Victorian people, for more sexually repressed Victorian people. But it's that ability of the park, though it remains architecturally remarkably uniform, the imagery that we have of it is as different as each decade.
Now, Doug, a listener has a very different kind of question, wants to know about the use of pesticides in the park, whether or not they're a danger to children.
Well, you know, any time you're using pesticides, you have to be extremely careful. And our goal is every year to use less and less and less. And in fact, in I would say 90% of our landscapes, we don't use any. In the areas that we do use it mildly, we close those off while they're being applied. So the park is extremely safe. And, you know, and as technology changes, every year we're going to reduce the amount. And it's a goal of ours. We are truly one of the greenest parks. We recycle. We recycle everything organic in the park.
green in the metaphoric sense as well.
In the metaphoric and the financial sense when you have to raise all that money.
How many people does it take to keep the park in top form?
We have a staff of over 300, and about 200 of them are actually in the park working on the ground. And then we manage the visitor centers as well, the public programs, the volunteer department. You know, we have over 250 or 300 volunteers that volunteer on a regular basis in the park, and they are just absolutely amazing people.
Do you think that because the park has once again been seen as something rather glorious, that that New Yorkers treat it better, don't throw their garbage onto the walkways?
Absolutely, but you
know, not finding beer cans the way you used to?
Not nearly like you used to. We on a busy weekend, it would take us 3 days to just clean up slightly. Now the park is basically litter-free 24 hours a day. But if we don't stay up with that, you absolutely start seeing it degrade again. So if there's graffiti in the park, we get rid of it immediately. If there's litter on the ground, we get it picked up. If a bench is broken, we get it fixed. And you have to keep it at that high level of maintenance, or it will go back.
That's something that Europeans have always understood, but we haven't always, because whenever we go through a budget crunch, parks, the arts, they're the first ones to take a hit.
Well, I think people are starting to come around and realizing that parks today really are economic engines, and that Central Park generates an incredible economy on its own, and that's not the place that you want to cut.
So, Andrew, what did you learn about the park in editing this book?
Well, it in many ways it validated and expanded my understanding of just how much it means to New Yorkers, but also to Americans and people throughout. Throughout the world, as you said, 38 million people a year on a beautiful day like this. Doug could probably tell there maybe 150,000 people using the park on a day like this. It's been our front yards, and it's been a refuge and a place we've played and grown up and gotten to know ourselves. And it's meant so much to me. It's part of why I'm giving part of my proceeds from the book to the Conservancy, which is without the Conservancy, the park would be who knows where we were back in 1979.
We have a lot. We've had a fair amount of rain this summer, so you don't have to water. But do you have to water at times?
Oh, yeah. On some of our bigger lawns, like the Great Lawn, the Sheep Meadow, lawns that get so much use, you do have to keep them moist. And but it's actually been a little dry, too.
But I should mention, too, that we went 20 minutes without mentioning skating in the park. David Michaelis, who wrote the great Charles M. Schulz biography, writes about fishing in the park. Alec Wilkinson writes about turtles in the park.
And Donald Faulkner wrote about wildlife in the park.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also interesting.
And Ben Dolnick, who's one of the great young writers in the country, wrote about his experience working at the zoo in the park.
Yeah, and people don't realize the park is on the Atlantic Flyway, so it is actually one of the best birding locations in the United States.
So, Adam, if you if somebody asked you what the best kept secret of the park is, what would you say?
Oh my goodness, what a good question! I think I would say two things. One is the Pinetum, which is a wonderful, fragrant, and beautiful part of the park that we don't spend enough time in. And the other thing I would say is the Ramble. The Ramble is an amazing space. It's a genuinely has a little tang of wilderness in the middle of the park, and it's the one place in New York City where you can actually, it seems to me, get lost, where you can lose your way off the grid. It is the most off-grid place in the city, and it's a place I dearly love to wander.
Doug, we have 10 seconds. What would you say?
You know, I really think people should get up to the North End. You know, I'd like people to, when a tourist asks, where's Central Park, we should be saying 110th Street, and then have them walk down to 59th Street, because the North End is spectacular.
My great thanks to all of you for being on our show. Doug Blonsky is president of the Central Park Conservancy, contributed to this collection called Central Park. So did Adam Gopnik. And Andrew Blauner is its editor. Thank you all for being on our show today.
Thanks so much.
Terrific to talk.